Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Cutting the Curd. This is your host, Greg Blaze, and on today's show, I'm happy to welcome Albert Strauss, a pioneer in organic dairy and sustainable agriculture and founder of Strauss Family Creamery in Northern California. How are you doing, Albert?
Great. How are you, Greg?
I'm fantastic. It's been only a couple of days since I've seen you, and I'm happy to talk to you again. Strauss has an amazing story, and I'm excited to hear more about your values and efforts to do business by those values, to be sustainable in every sense of the word. But first, I'd like to just start by talking a little bit about your background and what led you to a career in dairy following in your family's footsteps. What have been the challenges, in your history? Talk to me.
Okay. Let's see. I grew up on our family dairy farm in outside Marshall, California, which is on the Northern California coast above San Francisco. My father started in 1941. He had 23 cows, and we operated as a conventional farm for decades, trying to make it work as a family farm. And my parents were very active in trying to work with environmentalists, farmers, community members, to really try to protect and ensure the future of family farms in our community. And my mother started the first agricultural land trust in the nation, the Marin Agricultural Land Trust, in 1980. And so my history is I went to school in Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in dairy science and took a lot of manufacturing classes and won third place in regional contest in ice cream scoring. And so I always had my senior thesis was actually to put together a processing plant. And I put it out of my mind for a decade and a half or so. And then someone approached me about doing organic milk for ice cream. And it was 1990. It was a new law in California. And they gave up on the idea, but I kept looking into it. And 3.5 years later, I was able to open up as the first certified organic dairy and creamery west of the Mississippi River.
Amazing. That's amazing.
I can tell you a little bit more. Now we were the first one. Now there are 9 dairies, including my own, that supply our creamery. And we do reusable glass bottle milk, butter, yogurt, ice cream, sour cream, Greek yogurt, soft serve ice cream, all kinds of different things. And our main thing is we only do organic, 100% organic products, as well as they're kosher certified and non-GMO verified. We were the first. I found GMOs in our certified organic corn in 2005 and started my own verification program in 2008 and became the first non-GMO verified creamery in North America in 2010.
That's amazing. So when you hear that, what does the word organic mean to you exactly? You know, because that word gets thrown around a lot, and it's bled into every sort of television commercial and everything, you know, that I see. So when you tell me that you're organic and that you're certified, that means that everything is from the earth that creates it, correct? No help from mankind with any sort of supplements or, like you say, where GMOs, correct?
That's part of it. I think what it is a federal law, the National Organic Program that's administered by the USDA, that requires that the land is free herbicides, pesticides, and synthetic fertilizers for at least 3 years. And then in the case of dairy farms, the milk, so the cows have to be on all organic feeds for at least a year, and then the cows are not allowed to be treated with antibiotics or hormones. And once you have them transition to organic, they have to be treated organically from birth.
Excellent. So what has been the challenges in growing that business while you maintain the quality you're looking for? What's the biggest challenge you've had?
Well, I feel that our mission is to sustain family farms in Marin, Sonoma County, which is on the North Coast, and to produce the highest quality, minimally processed organic products, dairy products, and help to revitalize the rural community through education and advocacy everywhere. And our biggest hurdles are trying to make an economic system and a sustainable system for family farms, dairy farms. And I think we've become a lot closer to that ideal by working very collaboratively with the 9 farms that supply us, including myself, of course. The milk checks twice a month. We have someone from management that hand delivers those checks instead of mailing them or direct depositing them. And so we get a relationship. We have people from management at the creamery that get relationships with the farmers, understand their challenges, and how we can work better together. And then 4 times a year, we get together with all the dairies and talk about how the creamery is doing, and we talk about volume and price. And we keep the volume that the farms produce in line with our sales. So right now, there's a surplus of organic milk nationwide. And what's happened is everybody's dropping their prices to the farms. Everybody's dropping the amount of volume that they can accept. And we're able to maintain the price and the volumes very steady because we work so closely with them.
For me, you know, the relationships and the consistency of maintaining those relationships is always my biggest challenge, just to get product in as a retailer. You know, and that's like... Even that includes even like the mailing of checks and the receiving of checks. So that, you know, we're trying to cut out as many people in the middle as you possibly can to make that happen. You know what I mean? Like that seems to be the way, or that's the way I found it to be best for me. You know, maybe it's a little bit the same for you.
Right. I mean, I think I described the relationship we have with our farms, and we're also trying to create. Closer relationships with our customers as well, and see how we can better serve our customers and keep the quality of our products high and our mission, which is to sustain family farms. So, what I'm now trying to prove is that family dairy farms are a primary solution to climate change through carbon farming, methane digesters, organic farming methods, and getting off fossil fuels vehicles. And we have a 3-year plan to prove that our farm can be carbon positive. We have a carbon farm plan, a 20-year carbon farm plan, where we are projected to sequester 2,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. 80% of that comes from our methane digester, where we produce all the electricity from our farm from the waste from the cows, and then. 20% comes from adding compost to land and having animals graze the pastures and pulling carbon back from the atmosphere and putting it back in the soil. As well as we've just now announced the first fully electric feed truck in the world that is powered
by
a battery-powered truck, full-scale truck that's powered by the cow's waste. So closing.
Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit later about your cow poop truck, because I find that very interesting. But before I do that, you had mentioned that you also make yogurt. And I was wondering, what do you do with the whey byproduct of your yogurt making?
So the whey from our Greek yogurt is fed back to the cows as a feed. We, you know, hope to someday make products out of it, but for right now, it's not being wasted at all. It goes back to the cows.
Totally. We get a nice little yogurt producer who you met over the weekend with us, white mustache, and she turns the whey into drinks, which I guzzle because I've got a bad stomach, so it helps me out. And maybe you got some plans to do that sort of thing in the future. That might be cool. You might like that.
Yeah. No, I think it'd be a great way to go. There's always issues around the volume of the whey that you get and the sales of the product. So it's going to be a balancing act.
Cool. Where can people find your milk if they want to buy it?
We're distributed all over the West Coast, and we're a regional dairy. I didn't want to go national because I feel that the farming model is a regional model like it used to be, and that other farming communities around the country should be able to replicate it. And so our products are found in Whole Foods, Sprouts, some Safeways, and a lot of the independent and organic co-ops and food stores. So we're
cool.
We're all over. And then our ice cream mix is, there's some accounts that use it for their base for their making their ice cream, like Byright Creamery, Fairfax Scoop, in the Bay Area. And then we also have a barista milk that's accounts like Intelligentsia, Italy, different places are using as for their coffee drinks.
Awesome. Yeah, we love it. We're opening up, as you know, here in L.A., Italy is, and we're using your milk to make gelato. We're using your barista blend, and we're using it to make the white mustache yogurt. So we love your stuff. I know that Cowgirl Creamery uses your milk, and I'm sure your milk, as you mentioned, is used by many other folks to create other products. Do you guys make cheese, or do you have any plans to make cheese?
We're looking at making cheese in the near future, in 2018, hopefully.
What would be your dream cheese to make? What would cheese would you love?
Well, right now we're looking at mozzarellas and different type of Italian cheeses, and probably cottage cheese. But
So
we're still in the exploratory stages of those products.
Cottage cheese was tough. You know, I was buying cottage cheese from Cowgirl for a long time, but then they had to stop making it due to the amount of water that it used. And I'd really love to see it come back into the market. I mean, you probably run into the same problem when you think about making cottage cheese.
Well, water is a big resource for. I mean, it's a scarce resource for us. We've never had much water out on the coast in California. So we've actually made systems since I started to reuse and minimize our usage in the first place. So all the water that we reuse is reused between the creamery and the dairy, and then eventually all the wastewater goes into our digester where we're producing electricity out of it, and it goes back on our land. We've done a lot of things. Actually, the water we pull from our milk, which is called cow water, when we condense the milk, is reused for washing equipment as well.
That's awesome. I love that. I mean, I'm from from the Northeast. It's like a swamp up there. I mean, I just we complain about too much precipitation. Whenever I come out here, I'm always just shocked at frankly, at how wasteful we are with the water that we have on the East Coast, because we just have so much of it. And when I come out here, I'm forced to think in a different way. Thanks for rolling with me through that little technical difficulty. We're going to take a short break, and then when I come back, I want to talk to you about your values in action. And so just hang out with us, Albert, and hang out with us, listeners, and we'll be back in a second with more Cutting the Curd.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds, or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirsois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm speaking with Albert Strauss of the Strauss Valley Strauss Family Creamery. In this part of the show, I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about how you stay true to the values at the center of your company, which I know from speaking to you and my familiarity with the company are to preserve organic integrity, reduce your carbon footprint, support family farms, and take responsibility for what's happening in your local communities and our food system at large. You mentioned organics in the beginning, so I wanted to move on and ask you about your carbon footprint. And related to your carbon footprint, you mentioned more about your cow poop truck. I wanted you tell me, you know, about that and how that's going to reduce your carbon footprint, and just maybe generally about the culture of innovation at Strauss.
Sure. The electric feed truck has been an 8-year project of mine. That we were waiting for technology to catch up with the idea.
Yeah.
But what it is a 33,000 pound electric truck. It's a converted international truck that we've put an electric motor on, two Nissan Leaf worth of batteries, and It's charged. We charge it when we're not driving and feeding, but it's charged with electricity from us. Generate electricity from our methane digester, and it's offsetting about 18 metric tons per year that we're not using in diesel.
And that's amazing.
And it costs about $130,000 to convert. But if I was to buy a diesel-powered truck to replace it, it would have been $60,000 to $100,000. So since it was the first of its kind, I figured we had at least $20,000 or $30,000 extra in costs that we had to do if it was in production. So it was, we didn't have to go very far or very fast, but we need a lot of power. So it has a huge 170 horsepower, I think 950 pounds of torque motor. So big motor. I mean, small compared to a diesel motor, but it still has plenty of power to go up a steep hill and feed cows, and it works well. And it puts about 18,000 pounds of feed into a load, so it's a full. It does everything we need. It works 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
That's awesome. I love that. I love that. Yeah.
So you wanted to talk about innovation. I think what I try to do is encourage innovation and thinking about how can we do things better and more sustainably in every part of our operation. How can we close the loop? So there was we have a cream separator that was using 4,000 to 5,000 gallons of water a day. And I had an idea to reuse, to make a closed loop where we could save most of that water. And the dairy regulations didn't allow us to do that because it wasn't specified in the pasteurized milk ordinance. So I went to the state of California to the Secretary of Agriculture, and then they facilitated to allow us to do it. And so we're saving 3,000 to 4,000 gallons of water a day through reuse. And
that's incredible.
And then our glass bottles, I started out with glass bottles, reusable glass bottles, which are made out of 30% recycled glass. We put a $2 deposit on each bottle when it goes out to the distributor, the retailer, the consumer, and then the consumer brings it back to the store, it comes back to us, and they get the $2 back. And we get over 80%, 80 to 90% of our bottles back, and we get 4 to 6 uses out of a bottle on average.
And so that's great, man.
It's something that we feel that resources are finite. We need to do our part as a responsible member of the community, and those are things we try to do.
No, so, and it's interesting. You can't change one thing without the other. One of my favorite dumb movies is called, I think it's called Pumping Iron. It's with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he is talking about how he builds his body, and he can't change one muscle without changing all of the other muscles in the way they look, because it wouldn't look the same. So I feel like when you start to innovate and you do it in one portion of your business, then other parts where you can do that probably stick out. And then before you know it, you're closing the loops in all of your business and giving people a nice roadmap for how to be sustainable and responsible with their resources, which is really cool. And that leads me into my next question. That, you know, your value of taking responsibility for what's happening in your local communities. I wanted to talk briefly about the wildfires in Northern California recently. It was devastating just to see the images of destruction. But you guys are so close to what happened. Could you tell us a little bit about how you fared and how things are there right now in terms of that?
Well, the good news was that none of our dairies or animals were affected. But we had 25 employees that had to evacuate. We had them coming out to the coast where our farm and creamery are, and we housed a lot of them for a day or two. And then two of them lost their homes. And so we're trying to support them, and as well as it's really been encouraging to see the community come together. We had 17 employees volunteering at a shelter. We took our refrigerated truck and helped move for FEMA commercial kitchens. We helped move food. We donated product. So we're trying to do our best to help support our community. The fact is there's 8,000 homes that have been destroyed, and we're trying to figure out, you know, there's short-term needs, interim needs, and long-term needs, and we're trying to figure out how we can best help and, financially. There's no clothing, there's no, there's a lot of things that are needed right now. So it's, we're trying to figure out how the best way. But overall, the encouraging part is that everybody pulled together and is really working together well. The challenges are where do the people that didn't have insurance, didn't have their renters, they might be different legal statuses in this country.
Yeah.
How can we support everybody and make it work? And, there was a shortage of housing already, and it's been so expensive. It's really a huge challenge I think we need to address as quickly as possible.
Of course, everything is a la carte. The United States has become an a la carte country. It's ridiculous. You guys pitch in. It just seems like that's just what you do. You just pitch in and make things better. And through that, you're very much a part of the California food system. But I was wondering, my last question is, how does what you do and how you do it affect the larger U.S. food system, and does it at all?
What we're trying to do is to make a farming system and a food system that can be replicated everywhere else, around the country, around the world, and show that farming is actually can be positive for the environment, positive for the people working in the community and the local community, and also by providing high-quality organic foods locally. And so we on purpose haven't gone national with our products because we've tried to create a regional model. So I think that we have implications or we have influence around the country. We stay true to our values, and we don't take outside investors, because I feel that my mission and my values get diluted when we start bringing in outside influences and money. So we try to really move forward and create a really healthy farming community, because farming has been devastated in this country. You know, we had 4.6 million dairy farms in 1940, and now we have 40,000 left, and they figure there's going to be 20,000 in the next decade. So we need to change how we're doing farming and supporting our farms in our local communities.
Well, and people can definitely look to you as a beacon for how to stay, you know, ahead of all of the unfortunately nasty shit that happens in this country. I just wanted to say, you know, thank you so much for your time and for your awesome products that you gave us here at Eataly. So if you guys are lucky enough, listeners, to be in Northern California, you've got to buy Strauss milk, cream, butter, everything that these guys do, because it's amazing. And maybe someday they'll be available in other places, but you could come here to Eataly in Los Angeles and taste our gelato, or you could go to amazing Byright Creamery in San Fran and get Albert's stuff there. Thank you so much for your time, Albert. And I want to thank you all for listening, and stay tuned next week for more Cutting the Curd. Ciao.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.